Welcome to Living Martial Arts with Master Ray Gale, aka the Dark Master. Living Martial Arts discuss and examines the everyday exercise, philosophy, and lifestyle of the martial arts enthusiast. The host talks about his own training, past and present, and he also interviews many martial artists to discover how they continue to live their own martial arts journey. Tune in for top tips on how to get the best out of your martial art. Or perhaps you're thinking of starting a martial art. This podcast offers you an easy way to dip your toe in. Sign up for the newsletter at livingmartialarts.com and get regular updates and training tips direct to your inbox. Follow the Dark Master on Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram at Living Martial Arts.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to do this. Without sort of further ado, really, I'm going to start with my first question, is to really tell us a little bit about your martial arts journey, how it started, how it developed, and I can ask you some things from there. So the mic is yours.
All right. Well, no big deal. I probably come the classic route. I boxed as a kid. I came out of the army and I'm 65, and I just looked around for something to do because I was pretty fit lad. And I did everything from skydiving, rock climbing, whatever you could think of. And I boxed a bit, realized I wasn't going to be a world champion. And there was a karate club just down the road. It had originally been in the YMCA. And you know the YMCA is a red triangle for a logo? Well, the club called itself the Red Triangle, you know. And that was just down the road in Everton in Liverpool. Now, I didn't join them straight away, but I did join one of their instructors closer to me in Preston. And it was Prescott, rather. That was Frank Vernon. He was one of the founder members of the Red Triangle. And we had a little club there in the community center. It was used for dance and all that stuff. The floor was awful. You wore bare feet, like, and when you come off, looked like you had black socks on. So it was pretty bad. He was good. He brought people in. He brought Ronnie Caldwell in. I don't know if you've heard of Ronnie Caldwell. He was a Liverpool guy. He brought Inoida in. First time I ever seen a Japanese instructor. Just blew me away. And anyway, after a while, Frank said, you'd be better off training down at the Triangle. You know, you'll enjoy it there, and it's good. And he trained there every week anyway in the morning time. So I went to the Triangle and joined up with Andy Sherry and them guys. I was a little bit older than – I was closer to Andy's age than the student's age. So a few years older than Bob Poynton and Terry. And there was a few people there that were really, really good, you know. And like Frank Smith and Frank Green, I think it was. Can't remember his name. Alan Smith. Yeah, he was really good. So there was quite a few people there that were top line. And I didn't have any ambitions, really. I didn't know what I was getting into. It was all new. All I knew was I wanted to be good, probably as good as the guys in front of me that were teaching, because they just blew me away. They were doing things I'd never even thought of, and just pushing your body to the limits, you know, with trying to get physically fit. You can't do it if you're not fit, you know, that, like any kind of martial arts or sport. And all I wanted to do was get as good as them, just get better. So it was quite a surprise when, you know, the gradings come along and they go, well, you have to grade. I hated it, just hated gradings. I failed every single one, and even I have to take my showdown four times. I just went in there with the idea of killing everybody. I thought that was what you're supposed to do, you know. I think Inoida just got sick of seeing me when he gave me my black belt and said, yeah. But I'd become quite good friends with him because we used to go down to Crystal Palace every year, you know. And we used to actually train to go to a training camp so that we were the best there. That was Andy's philosophy, you know, and Frank Brennan and all them. We'd all train extra to go to a training camp so that we could get through it and we could look good, you know, and frighten everybody.
I had a very similar experience, actually, you know, training to go to a training camp because I didn't want to look silly and fail within the first half. But just coming back to what you said there, you mentioned about the red triangle. I mean, that was quite a well-known gym. I remember reading the martial arts magazines 70s, and it was always mentioned, you know, people like Terry O'Neill and Frank Brennan and Poynton and Andy I mean, there was quite a lot of things in there. What was it like? What was it like training there?
It was tough. It was always full. You got there at before 6 o'clock. That was the advanced class started at 6. They put the beginners on after the advanced. So you got to the you got into the club, and if you went there at 6, they just closed the door, and you were outside then. Mm-hmm. And it was a pay by class when I was there. Now, I did okay there. In fact, Andy asked me to teach the kids class, and I taught people like Miles Draper and Tony Harrison, who were big names on the English team later on, you know, and they won a couple of national titles. But I also managed to stay good friends with a lot of other karateka around there, like Steve Cattle, who was in the Kirkdale Club. He wasn't in the Triangle, but he was in the Kirkdale Club. A really nice man, Stevie. I got on very well with him. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of his people as well, you know, from that club. They were some tough lads, Jimmy Farley. And Joe Farley was in the Triangle. He was a tough lad. He was a big 6-foot-odd guy. I always remember the first fight I ever seen him fight against Ronnie Christopher. Ronnie Christopher was, I don't know if you know Ronnie Christopher, he was a champion on the Brits team for a while. It was in Chester. It was about, 78, 79, maybe even earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were at Chester, and it was a competition run by Sato, who was, you know, we had to ask permission to go to other clubs' competitions. So Andy didn't care. He didn't really like it, but, you know, he said, okay. So we went there, and the final was Joe Farley against Ronnie Christopher. Ronnie Christopher was this extremely gymnastic, agile little guy. He turned out to be a monster karate guy, but Joe couldn't catch him. He just couldn't catch him. And about the third time, Sato shouted, "Jamme, bring them past the middle." He grabs Ronnie Christopher as they're walking back to their own marks, like they had to cross, and he picks him up, butchered him, and dropped him on the floor. Sato goes, "You're disqualified." And Joe goes, "Yeah, I know. It's okay."
Yeah, old days. But I mean, Liverpool was quite was then and still is, because I know a lot of martial artists from Liverpool. You know, competed on the freestyle circuit in the early 80s, and you knew that when you came up against somebody from Liverpool, you're always in for a tough fight. It was a tough, I would imagine, similar to how I grew up in Bristol, a tough place to grow up in.
Yeah, it was tough. It still is. I don't know why it was tough. I think because it was just a hard way of life. You know, when I came up, I was born 1 week after the war, so I was basically a war orphan. And so I grew up just, just fighting to survive on bomb sites and stuff like that. Yeah. And what I did in Liverpool is I managed to get a Hackney plate, and then I built up a few Hackney cabs that I drove around the town. And if you didn't get into at least one fight a week, then it was a very quiet week, you know, because they looked on not so much a mode of transport, more like an income source, you know.
Yeah.
there was always people trying to run off, you know. So you got to judge people very well, but you got into some serious scraps. And what karate did is it gave me a little bit more of an arsenal. Like I'd never usually just butt somebody and then hit them as many times as you could, which you knew. And this is how I managed to pick up my timing. You kind of read the situation, and rather than wait for the guy to act, you attacked his intention. You know, and I mentioned that in a book, like attacking his intention. It's what he intends to do. Like, there's a bunch of questions. You've probably been in pubs, and there's a bunch of questions that people throw at you, and there's no answer to them. So you might as well just batter him anyway.
Yeah.
So somebody says, "Who are you looking at?" You know, there's no answer to it, right? I mean, you can make a joke of it, but if they're in serious, you're not going to get away with the joke. He's obviously thinks you're going to back down, and you know, he'll pick up on it. So the answer to that question is smack him in the mouth.
Yeah, that preemptive strike.
That's the intention.
I learned that. I remember, I think it was early 80s, I went to a Jeff Thompson seminar in Coventry.
Yeah.
You know, I was expecting they do this and you do it. He said, no, just hit him.
Jeff Thompson, Peter Constantine, Terry O'Neill, Frank Vernon, he worked the clubs in Liverpool for a long time. So I got a lot of practical information from Frank and all that. Yeah. And I just got like, what happened with Liverpool, why I left, was basically it was Maggie Thatcher. She was trying to flatten the place.
Yeah.
And business went out because they took the number of the limits off the plates on the cabs. And so basically it was like everybody had a cab then. So you couldn't earn a living. So I applied for and I got a job in Canada, and the company brought me over and I came to Calgary. And I never left Calgary because within a week I'd picked up a karate club. Didn't really like it, but I stayed there for about a year. And then I thought, it's not what I'm doing. Like, there was nobody that could teach me anything. Mm. And I was only a knee dan at that time. But there was nobody here that could teach me. And so I started my own club.
Right. But
I phoned up Andy Sherry and Sensei Onoida, and they said, train with Nishiyama. And I said, but he's in L.A., he's in Los Angeles. And they go, well, it's not far, is it? You know, they look on the map, but yeah, it's closer than Sorrento, but it's not. It's 3,000 miles, you know. So it's 3 hours flight. But I went down there at least once a month, and I went to every one of his camps.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was an amazing teacher. He was absolutely brilliant. The way he structured his classes, what he knew about body mechanics and physiology was unbelievable. And he was one of the authors of the JKA Instructors course, which produced all of these great masters. So I felt very lucky to be able to train with him as much as I could. And I got an awful lot out of it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, there's a few things I want to ask you about. I want to get onto some of your books as well. But I was reading a little bit about you, and it mentioned that your passion for the history of karate and also the kata as well. I don't know, perhaps tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I like kata, and I try to find out as much as I can about it. And the one guy, you probably got more information on kata than anybody, is a guy called Patrick McCarthy. I don't know if you've heard
of him. Yes, I do. Yeah, I have. Yeah, yeah.
Patrick is an amazing guy. Now, he lived in Vancouver in the early 80s when I first came over. And I actually trained with him and a mate of his called Ken Tallick in London, Ontario at that time. Mm. And Patrick had all of these theories on habitual acts of physical violence and stuff like that, which all made absolute sense. And the way he interpreted kata was, it's just little packages of self-defense techniques that you practice. Mm. And each one of them is separate, but they're all put together in a form that will flow. You know?
Yeah.
And the embassy or the line of the kata doesn't really matter at all, because they were never performed in a dojo. They were usually performed in a small backyard when they were, you know, originally formed in Okinawa.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that really started to interest me, so I got into it a lot, and I started to look at the applications of the different forms and the different things. And my belief is there's no style in karate. There's no style really in martial arts. The only thing that distinguishes one from the other is the katas.
Yes.
Know, the style does this kata. But basically, you're doing the style or the type of karate that particular person did, because everybody develops their own style eventually. Mm-hmm. If you take, say, Onoida, Kase, Shirai, any of the Japanese instructors that even came from the same instructor school, and you asked them all to do a kata, they'd all look different. Mm. Because Inoue did Inoue karate and Shirai did Shirai karate. They were doing the same thing, but they were doing it in their own way with their own interpretation of what worked and what didn't work, because everybody's built different, right? Yeah. I'm not a big guy. I'm a short guy. I'm only 5'6". But if I apply anything from the kata, I don't change the technique, but how I use it will be different from, say, a guy who's 6 foot. But I'll make it work. And I think that's how you look at kata. You take the movements and you make them work for you. And if you can make them work, and as Stevie Cattle used to say, does it work fast? It doesn't work. So yeah, it's got to be real, you know. And yeah, very often it is. And you tend to keep it simple and you go for certain techniques. It's like, you know, if you have a favorite kick, you're going to use it a lot. You know, and I used to always, when I coached the provincial team here for years, and I was supposed to coach the national, but the way that Canada is, it's too bloody big. So what I'd say to them, if you score, say you score with a front kick, keep doing that front kick till you score again. You know, if he figures out how to block it, fine, then switch.
Yeah.
Keep going at it, you know. Yeah. It's just like if you throw a punch and it gets in, you're going to throw another punch.
Yeah.
It works that way. But yeah, I really like the history on the katas, and somebody like Pat McCarthy has got an amazing brain. I mean, he's multilingual. The way he picks up on, and he can read the stuff, you know, the older stuff as well. The way he picked up on it all and the way he explains it is very, very good.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if you heard of it. I looked at read a book. I think I've got it here somewhere. It's called Barefoot Zen, and it was by a guy called Brian Johnson, I think. And he was.
I've got Moving Zen by C.W. Nicol.
Yeah. I think Barefoot Zen, I mean, what he was saying was that there are certain moves within the martial arts where you cross your hands here, which was very familiar to all martial arts. And, you know, as you mentioned there, you know, depending on, I'm on the same height as you, I'm 5'6", depending on your stature. But I would agree with that because, you know, I've managed to train with a lot of the world taekwondo masters.
Yeah.
And they all do it very different.
Yeah.
They're all very different. You know, they might be doing, all right, this is this technique. Yeah. But actually, the way they deliver it and the way they use it is very different.
Yeah, it's idiosyncratic to their own body, right? Because you have to wear your body. But talking about that crossed hands in front of the face, that's an instinctive thing. I worked a lot on that and the techniques that come out of it. Because if somebody, if you see a little kid and somebody goes to hit him, his hands are up.
Right? Yeah.
It's an instinctive thing. And then you just extrapolate from that into whatever you're going to do. So even your basic blocks, like your upward block, your hands come in front of your face and you go from there. So a lot of it is instinctive, but it's taking that instinct and making it a technique. So what is instinct and what's automatic becomes a technique. So your response becomes a reaction, you know.
Sure. Just sort of moving back a little bit from there, you mentioned about you know, teaching children and so on. I think you know, martial arts now, there's a lot of kids that are learning martial arts. I mean, when I started, even you know, I started a long time after you, but you know, I was considered quite young at 15, 16 to start at the time. But we had no youngsters younger than that. But, you know, are you teaching youngsters younger than that? Or when you started, were the children, how young were they?
No, most of the kids that came, you couldn't get in the triangle until you were a certain age. In fact, Frank Brennan had to wait. He was cheesed off because he couldn't get in when he wanted to. His brother could, but he couldn't. And so he went and took jiu-jitsu with Britain, Professor Britton's. And so that's why he's pretty good at forward rolls and sweeps and throws, right? Hmm. But he's good at everything, booger. But yeah. They didn't take any kids in. And then as you got later, Andy said, okay, we'll take kids like between 9 and 12. Yeah. And that's how Miles Draper and Tony Harrison and a whole bunch of other kids came in. Hmm. I was used to take them on a Sunday morning at the Triangle, usually before the squad training, and Noida and them came in for squad training. So nowadays, unfortunately, a lot of people look on it as a babysitting service.
Yes.
And we never used to take, I still wouldn't allow kids in my dojo under 9 right up until about 8 or 9 years ago. And then one of the lads said, I've got a couple of little kids and they really want to train. Can I teach the kids class? Well, he was a sandan. I said, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So I watched him for a bit and I developed a little syllabus on teaching kids because their attention span is like 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. So you got to interest them. But the thing about kids is they're really competitive.
Yeah.
And because it's natural. We're all just animals and it's survival of the fittest. So competition is part of your DNA, your lizard brain.
Yes.
So if you can make a competition for them, even small competitions like who can jump over the bench this many times or, you know, who can race up and down the dojo this many times, simple competitions that just build their strength, get their bones forming the right way. Make sure they're not doing silly things, you know, because so many times I've been in classes where, say, a Japanese instructor's coming, I'm not mentioning any names, but some of them did silly exercises that would just damage your body.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd do bunny hops all around the bloody dojo once for half an hour. I could hardly walk when I come out.
Yeah, we used to do those.
Yeah. No, it just does not good for your body, you know.
Well, I think I'm a, you see, I was always had a strong mind that I wanted to be the best at everything, but one of them. So I ended up with a hip operation and a knee operation. So
yeah, me too. I've got fused ankle, 2 knees, and 2 hips.
Yeah. So,
but I'm getting on to 80, so you know.
There we go. You're doing well for it.
Pass me sell by date.
That's for sure. Well, coming back to your, I mentioned about your books, and you've written some books.
Yeah.
I've written one recently. I don't know. Perhaps you can give us an overview of why you started and your first ones and how it went on from there.
Yeah. Well, I wrote a few articles for Terry's Fight and Arts magazines in the past. In fact, I used to be the North American distributor for him.
Hmm.
And, I kind of like writing because it makes you think, you know, you really go into depth. Because if you're going to put it down on paper, you better know what you're talking about. Otherwise, there's always people who pick it up and rip it to pieces, and that's all they do for a living. But what I found, I wasn't great at karate. I was good enough. I could hold my own. But I never made the A team in the Triangle. I was a bit too old for that. So that was people like Joe Farley and Frank Brennan and John Bolton, who was brilliant, by the way, and Bobby Poynton and all them, and Terry. They were the number one team. But we had backups, you know, like myself and Jerry Brown and a couple of other guys. So and I never was number one, but I did like competing, but I always used to get a little bit over-enthusiastic. But I took a couple of... Canadians. I took the Canadian Masters title. They brought in a Masters division in 89 or 90. And I took that first in Kumite, second in Kata. And that's the way it was always doing. Even with Ray Dahlke's competition, the last competition I did, I was 50. I took first in Kumite, second in Kata. But what I found out I did best was teach. And Ray used to take me down to California to teach his clubs. I used to teach at camps. And I really liked it because I'd prepare to teach. And I tried to put across everything that, not just what I'd done, but what I'd seen done. And I leaned a lot on Nishiyama's teaching. I leaned a lot on Onoida's teaching and Andy Sherry to a certain extent. And all of them, in fact, anybody I'd ever jumped in a class with, I used that kind of experience and I built on it. And then I looked at why you did it. And I tried to mimic analytical side of it, like Pat McCarthy did. And so what I found that I did best was teach. So the first book I wrote was How to Teach Shotokan Karate.
Right? Okay.
And I didn't just do the basics. So this is how you make a block. This is how you make the kick. We went through the physiology. There was a little section on history. There was a little section on the philosophy, which I really got into as well. And then I also did how you manage a club, which different ways you can run a club, you know, profit, non-profit, out of a community center, out of your own building. Fitness training, how you kept your fitness training up. And also I did a lot of first aid, you know, to look after your students. So I thought that was important. And actually, when I've been in the dojo, I've come across injuries and you just get used to knowing it. I probably know as much about anatomy as your average doctor.
Yeah, sure.
That's what I found I did best.
Yeah.
Then that was the first book I wrote, which was quite a bigger book and, you know, of color plates and that. And I was quite pleased with that. And I used that as a basis for an instructor course that I developed, which is 22 modules. And we do it over a 16-week period, but you come out with an instructor certification and, you know, I'll let you know where you're going wrong. We cover all of the Shotokan katas, and then a couple of extra ones because I've always been interested in other katas as well. So we just throw them in. And then the second book I wrote was more on the philosophy, on what it meant to me and how I developed my own training and how I thought about it. Now, the thing when you're writing a book is it can get away with you, right? So it's not always what you put in it. It's what you leave out. You have to leave out.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
You have to leave a lot out. But I tried to make it interesting. I'm not really bothered if it doesn't sell a million copies. I don't care. Mm. It's just something I've left behind. And it's been quite favorably received by a lot of people. So I'm okay with that. You know?
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, I think you know, particularly for martial arts enthusiasts, it's always great to have, you know, good material, you know, reference material to look at. And I think, you know, having something of from all the arts is great. So, you know, well done to you on that. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, if you looked at my library behind me, there's like, I don't know, 1500 books.
Yeah.
But I've got Masoyama's early books on Kokushinkai.
Yes.
I've got a massive big volume by Tadeshi on Hapkido, which is one of the best books I've ever seen.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I've got one of those books. Yeah.
Tadeshi. Have you?
Yeah.
Tadeshi,
yeah.
Hapkido. It's great, isn't it?
I've got mine are all hidden behind here. You see, I've got
I can see it.
Lots of books here.
Yeah.
But these are all my martial arts books here.
And the other thing I've got is probably one of the biggest collections of fighting arts magazines from Terry, when I wrote a few articles and stuff for him.
I've got a few of those magazines somewhere because I used to collect the fighting arts and combat in the early days. As well. So that was great. No, fantastic, isn't it? And it's always good to I always find it good to look back at these books.
I've got tons of stuff by Patrick McCarthy because I used to be I was just a member of his association for maybe 20 years. I didn't train the same way as he did, and he knew that, because whenever he came, like, he came to Calgary a few times, and we always got together for a good long chat because we'd known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
And he used to put out a magazine every quarter,
Right.
He wrote an article on me years ago. But the stuff he put out, really, it was really good. Made you think. It went in real deep, you know. So it was very interesting that way.
Yeah.
Particularly his theories on habitual acts of physical violence. Like, he theorizes that different people go to habitual acts of offensive behavior just naturally. Like, if you go to Liverpool or Glasgow, you're more than likely to get butted in the head than kicked.
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt. Well, perhaps we can be nice to put some of those links to some of those books in the show notes as well. So anybody that wants to pick those up and have a look at them, you know, and purchase them can do that. Definitely.
Yeah, my books are on Amazon.
Okay.
So you can look at them there, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody, if you go searching for any book you're looking for, it's interesting. But Amazon, I find it's a great platform for publishers. Now anybody can write a book. And as long as you format it well and you look after your grammar and all the rest of it, just put it on Amazon and they do it all for you. It's just ready to print to order. So you can get it anywhere in the world. They've got a lot of sales come in from Australia and stuff like that. And they really like it, you know.
No,
they're not how-to books. They're more make-you-think books, you know.
Yeah. I actually wrote a plan to write a few books. I wrote one in 2011, which was called Black Belt Success Plan, and it was basically a book about goal setting using martial arts. But and I was due to write more, but unfortunately, I was sort of caring for my mother around the same time, and then she passed. One thing to another, but I'm trying to get back to it again now.
Yeah, you should, because it's good for your mind. You know, you start to express yourself.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, because you start to branch out into different ways. And if you're like me, I never stop learning, right? Mm-hmm. If I see something and it interests me, I research the hell out of it to see, you know, how it works or what makes it attractive or, you know. Sometimes the math is beyond me if I go into something like physics or something like that, but, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I was a slide drill guy before they ever had computers.
Oh yeah, well, me too. When I left school, I was an aircraft engineer. But
oh yeah,
we had overhead projectors. We had microfilm things, but we had no computers, and it was all slide rules and everything.
Yeah, slide rules and log tables.
log tables, all that sort of thing. So what you know, obviously martial arts has been your life, and you obviously live it every day. So what do you do to get away from it? Because I think it's always
I never want to get away from it, to be honest.
Well, not get away, but you know what I mean, when you want to get into a slightly different environment, let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, I go to the gym 3 times a week in the winter. And then we go to the golf simulators and we play golf in the summer.
Oh, wow.
I love golf. Yeah. I used to play with Anoida Sensei.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of pictures of us playing down in Palm Springs. And it reminded me, because I was down in Palm Springs just a few weeks ago playing golf, and I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, I miss that guy.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great game, isn't it? I played when I was at, as I say, as an engineer, I used to do a night shift, and we all came off night shift and went to the golf course.
I'm no good at it, but you know, I like it.
Oh, nor am I.
It's like karate, you know, you just do it and you hope you get better, you know.
Yeah. It's always in the distance trying to get to perfection that you'll never reach.
Yeah. And the thing is, you're not playing against anybody else, you're just playing against yourself, which is, you know, most of the time in the dojo, that's what's happening. I mean, you may be, people say, okay, it's for self-defense or it's for fighting or sport. I don't really like the sport kind of it, but I like the fact that it gives you strength of character and it builds resilience, you know, all of the good things that people need to get by.
Yeah.
Karate will build that in you. Any martial arts will. And people who've been training for as many years as, say, you have, you're going to develop this philosophy, whether you realize it or not, that it's just good for you. It's good for your mind. It's good for your body, you know. And that's one thing that everybody should take from it. Not these stupid questions like, oh, who do you think could win, karate or boxing or karate or UFC? Doesn't matter.
No.
That's not what you're there for, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, you mentioned sport there, which was quite interesting, because my style of taekwondo is the sort of the first or traditional style, if you want to call it that, ITF style. And obviously, taekwondo has sort of gained a bit of notoriety because of the Olympics, which is the WTF style, which is a different style. Now, I was quite vociferous when taekwondo went to the Olympics. I don't think it was a good thing. And I still don't think it's a good thing because, you know, they changed the rules to make it easier to understand.
It's terrible.
I don't think it's for me now, it's lost all its realism. So I'm sort of asking really about, you know, what your thoughts on karate in the Olympics, because people
like it. I don't like it at all. I run probably the only traditional karate competition in the province. I run two a year, and we all use the old JKA rules, which have been around since 55.
Yeah.
And I don't like the way that they run the WKF karate. When you look at the Olympics, it was a farce, an absolute farce. The guy who won lost, right? He kicked the other guy and he got disqualified, and so this guy won. Well, that goes against everything that the karate stands for. And then they're just dancing around, and then the way they do the katas, it's nothing more than a weird dance. And that's not what kata's for. And then you go, oh, this is the ladies' kata and this is the men's kata. I'm going, what's the difference?
Yeah.
You're doing the same thing, right? So what's the difference, you know? And they've got all this thing about trans men and trans women. You could mix them all up in kata, nobody'd know, you know? And it's the same with styles. And I mentioned this in the book. Styles don't mean a thing. If you're fighting in a kumite match, right, somebody smacks you in the mouth, you go, sir, don't say, oh, that guy was Goju, or oh, that guy was, you know, Chitaru or Shotokan. You don't know. You got to say it's in the mouth. That's it. There's no style there, you know.
That's a good point. That is a good point. Yeah. So a punch is a mouth. It doesn't matter what style you're going to get it.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, that's a good point. Well, we're sort of coming towards the end of the podcast, but what I want to ask is, I found when I was younger, you know, I was competition, which I sort of fell into it really. Now I'm a bit older. I've sort of, my philosophy is very different. I do love the philosophical side of the art, I do a little bit of meditation, which is difficult for me because I'm quite a hyper person, and I never thought I'd be able to sit still for long enough. And I just wondered whether, you know, within what you teach, you explore that, or is it something that people explore on their own?
When I was coaching, I got into the meditation side of it. And at the end of a really hard session, I'd have all of the guys lie down on the floor, and I'd tell them to picture going through their last fight, and whether they won it or they lost it, but better if you lost. So what did you learn from that last fight? Because you learn more from losing than you do from winning, right? You think it's sheer luck. You don't consciously go, oh, there it is, I'll punch you. You just react. It's only more reaction, which is very good. I mean, that's what we're after. But when you lose, obviously you didn't react. So what did you learn from it? And the one thing that is constant with all sports, and I don't care which sport you do, whether it's golf or, you know, high jump, long jump, is speed. You have to build speed. And the way to build speed, if you haven't got a lot of natural fast twitch muscle fiber, which is, you know, what differentiates a fast athlete from a slower athlete, is fast twitch muscle fiber, right? So if you haven't got that, you can still get faster by being more efficient.
Mm.
And the way you get to be more efficient is with doing the same thing over again, over and over and over again. And until you get really familiar with the movement, of course, it only works if you're doing it right.
Yeah.
Right? Look at doing the same thing over again if you're doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's what I stick in my mind when I'm teaching. The last thing I'm going to do is teach you how to do it wrong.
Yeah. Right?
You're going to do it right every time until you can't get it wrong.
Yeah.
And then that way you're going to get efficient and you're going to build speed because it'll become reactive. It's just going to be straight reaction and you're going to build speed. You don't see that in the sports style of karate. And the sports style of karate is what I don't like about it. So it's a limited time length. There's a goal and you got to reach it before, I don't know, you're 30, 35. It's like footballers, right?
Yeah.
You don't see anybody my age doing sport karate.
Right.
Well, you can come along to my dojo and there's people in the 50s and 60s and we're all training together and we're just doing what we can do because we know it's good for our minds and it's good for our bodies. When you're in the dojo, basically when you're working away, your mind is on a meditation level. It is actually moving Zen. You're right in the moment. You're right there. You can't not be there. Otherwise, your body wouldn't do what you wanted it to do. I just thought of something. I had a guy come to my classes. He was a Taekwondo champion in the late 80s, early 90s. His name was Everald Wright.
All right, yeah, yeah.
Do you know him?
I've heard that name, yes, yes.
Really? Okay. Yeah, and he wanted to teach him how to punch.
Yeah.
And that guy, oh, man, he was flexible and fast. He reminded me a lot of Alfie Lewis, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was tall. He was about 6'3", and just legs and arms everywhere, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. If you can, once we finish this, if you can hang around, perhaps we'll talk about getting some links into the show notes as well. But I want to say thank you very, very much for taking the time. I know you're in Canada. I think it's going to be 11 o'clock now in the morning where you are.
Yeah, just ready for me morning coffee.
six o'clock in the evening where I am in the UK. But thank you very, very much. One thing I hope that we can talk again at some point. You never know, I might make it to Canada again at some point. And
you're very welcome. Yeah,
come visit and
bring your clubs.
Yes, bring the club. Yes, definitely, and say hello. But I want to say thank you very much. I hope all the Living Martial Art Podcast fans has enjoyed the talk that I've had with Mr. John Hanratty, 8th Dan in Shotokan. It's been very, very interesting. I'm going to put some links in the show notes to some of the books that he's written, and hopefully you'll find those interesting as well. But thank you very, very much.
No problem.
And as they say in Korean, "Kumshamnida," which means. So if you stay there a moment, I'll just one second. Let me.